And at 25 and a half after the hour, we're in touch with Dr. Don Clark because it's Tuesday, and we do this on Tuesday. We look forward to his visit each and every week. Don is a biochemist with years of pharmaceutical experience. He's a member of the Board of Creation Moments and also a vintner in Garden Valley, Texas. Don, good morning. Happy Tuesday. I've heard of this gap theory from time to time, but never really looked into it. And it's an interesting chapter in the history of exegesis. It happens in the late 19th century when there's volumes of scientific information starting to circulate, some of it from geology and people discovering that, hey, there have been earthquakes and volcanoes and all these changes through history. And look at the Bible. Between Genesis 1:1 and Genesis 1:2, that is the first and second verses, there seems to be a word there that implies that the earth was older than creation week. And biblical scholars, apologetics, and apologists rallied and decided, well, if it's science, it must be true. We've got to come up with an explanation. And hence the gap theory. Is that a good beginning to the discussion this morning?
Yeah, that's an excellent beginning because that's seemingly exactly what happened with the theologians. They're saying so the geologist at that time, Charles Lyell, was the first one to basically come out and say, "Hey, you know, the geology looks like the Earth is old. And matter of fact, it looks like it's very old." And of course, that spurred Darwin on a little bit later to say, oh, we got to have an explanation for how these living things could have come about. So he came to the conclusion of which, you know, the evolutionary theory of living organisms, of course. Looking at geology and looking at the folds and looking at, oh, gee, this piece of rock should be over here, but it's way over there. How did that get there? Obviously, long time had to be involved. These multiple layers that we see in the Earth's crust, how did that form? And so the theologians, instead of reading further in the Bible and saying, okay, that's a result of the great flood or a global flood, they caved. I don't know why they caved, but they caved.
Well, it looks like theologians at the time pretty well accepted that the Earth was about 4,000 years old. Now, all of a sudden, there's science and Darwinism espousing ideas that would have taken longer than that to develop. And so they responded not by defending Scripture as it existed, as it was known, but by making something up.
Basically, and they stretched some of the Hebrew words and changed them in order to change the meaning in order to fit that there had to be something going on from the first verse in the Bible and the second verse in the Bible. So, you know, the first verse obviously says, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And then the second verse starts off, and the earth was formless and void, and there was darkness over the face of the deep. And so we had, you know, a dichotomy that, wait a minute, verse 1 says that the earth was already formed, and verse 2 says the earth is formless and void. And so what's the deal here? And so they began to, you know, question the interpretation of the word Tohu wabohu, which is formless and void in Hebrew. And they began to say, well, and the word haya, which is the word for was, they changed that to haya el or lel. They mean became. So the earth became formless and void. And that's where they went off track. And then they said, well, there had to be, you know, we're going to account for this time gap that we see in geology and what we see from the rest of Scripture. And we're going to just say there was a big gap. We don't know how long that gap was. We're looking for evidence as to when did Satan fall and the angels fall away, and when did they rebel? So we got to have a time frame for that. So they stuck that in the gap as well. And so they were satisfied. Okay, this now corresponds to what we're finding from a geological point of view, and we fit everything in. So we're happy. So you can't add to Scripture or take away from Scripture, and that's a little bit of what they actually did there, because they believed that the science was conclusive in saying that the Earth was quite old. But Archbishop Usher, he came up with a date for the beginning of creation, which was 4,004 years BC for the origin of the Earth. And so they're saying, well, this the geology is looking like it's much, much older than that. And so Usher's probably, because Usher's basis for dating was the genealogy that's found in Genesis. You know, it outlines clearly that, Adam begot, Seth, and Seth begot so-and-so, and, so-and-so begot this. And so you add up, and it tells you exactly how many years they lived. And so you add all of that up, and then you come up with, well, I mean, it had to be that the creation started, at least the beginning of man started 4,000 years ago. I mean, 4,000 BC, not 4,000 years ago. And so therein, lies the problem.
Well, the gap theory kind of caught on with some people and some noteworthy theologians, and I'm wondering if there's anybody today that still hangs on to it. I noticed the name C.I. Schofield, the Schofield Study Bible, is a big deal, and apparently he still thinks, or the Bible still touts an older Earth than 4,000 years because of this gap theory. So in your studies, I know you presented Genesis many times. Do you ever have anybody standing up and saying, wait a minute, what about that gap? Does anybody care anymore about this?
Yeah, I mean, years ago, it was, I wouldn't say it was necessarily universally accepted, but it was popular in some realms. And I'm sure there's people today that go along with the gap because it fits better with, the geology is, the geologists haven't changed their mind that the Earth is millions and millions of years old. They do recognize that man obviously wasn't around millions of years ago. But so they hang on to it because it's a convenient explanation for that.
Well, you may remember recently we covered an article that talked about evolutionists who have, and the study of cosmology, people studying with all the new telescopes and everything, finding things in the universe that seem to be older than the agreed upon scientific age of the universe. And so the knee-jerk reflection was, well, let's double the age of the universe, and we'll explain all that.
Right.
Another artificial
solution.
Instead
of looking at it, the basis that, hey, that galaxy appears to be, or those clusters of galaxies appear to be really old. They're nicely formed. They're tight spiral galaxies. And, if they were, in that particular discussion, we discussed that, general cosmologist would say that the further out that you go in space, because it takes so long for light to travel here, that we're looking back in time. And therein lies the problem, you know, because if you're looking back in time and we think that the universe is 13, you know, 0.8 billion, it may have increased since the last time I looked at that number. Then, you know, these the galaxies couldn't have, you know, been formed and be such tight-knit galaxies that the telescope was now you know, finding.
You know, all that should convince us of how tentative their numbers are. They have so little confidence in what they have said is the case that they change it at the drop of a hat.
Well, and the problem is the assumptions. So you really have to look at the assumptions. So what are, you know, what are cosmologists using on the basis of their dating of the astronomical objects, for example, that they see with their telescopes versus what the assumptions are. And one of the assumptions is that the time travels through space in a linear fashion. And Einstein says, well, you know, that's not really the case, because we know that massive objects distort space. And if you have a star, a bright star behind a massive object, then the massive object's going to act like a lens and distort the image and have the light kind of travel around. And indeed, you see maybe a double image depending on the alignment of everything that you would expect if you put a lens in front of in front of a light source. And so space is distorted. It's not linear. It's greatly distorted, and it's condensed around massive objects. So the more mass you have, the more compressed, if you will, space is. Now, what does that do with the speed of light? Nobody has addressed that. You know, they say, well, the speed of light is constant. Is it? I mean, is it really? I mean, if space is stretchy, and we talked about this before, if space is stretchy, then the speed of light, why would you expect the speed of light to be constant? I mean, maybe within a little space bubble, it's constant. But if that bubble is stretched out, then you can't associate the distance of an object that's in space with a certain amount of light years, time, because the apparent speed of light in stretchy space would be much faster than the apparent speed of light in a compressed space. I don't know if I'm making any sense.
Well, you know, I can't help but think of an example of this, and to me it makes it clear, because I see this almost every day when I drive my wife to work. There's a section of road which it goes off to quite a distance to my right, and I have to cross that road. I'm at a stop sign, so I'm looking for traffic, and there are oncoming cars that appear that they're they're coming so fast and so close that I should wait for them to cross, and then they disappear. Well, they go down a slope, and then they come up the other side of the slope and appear once again. So the actual distance they have to travel is much longer, much farther than what my eye tells me. So it's kind of a deceptive thing, but it's like light traveling across the undulating surface of say, fabric, where it goes up and down and around, and these are all the fabric is created by gravitational forces then, that is the mass of objects in space, so it's not void, it's filled with energy.
Yeah, well, it's filled with stuff. It's filled with massive things, you know, just like the Earth distorts space a little bit and distorts time. The sun distorts space even more. It condenses space around it even more than the Earth does, and so forth and so on. So the more massive the object there is. So let's get back to the geology question here, as to how old the Earth really is. from the point of what the geologists were observing, that is these folds, these layers, they interpreted the layers of requiring, millions of years to form in the sediment layers. We know now that you can get sediment layers formed within a day, as an example at Mount St. Helens. Mount St. Helens, you recall, blew up in the 80s and erupted in the 80s, and there was a frozen lake on top of the mountain, and that water melted, that ice melted, and it came crashing down one of the sides of the mountain, and it took trees and it took dirt and created mud and created basically subsequent sliding down the mountain created a 100-plus-foot canyon, striated 100-foot-plus canyon in a day or less than a day. And so we, of course, as young Earth creationists, we look at the geology we see around the Earth and we say, and the folds and the layers, and we say, oh, that's evidence of the Great Flood. And so, you know, the layers formed, they formed quickly as these great tsunamis were crashing in on the Earth that was splitting apart as the Earth split apart. And so you had, as we've spoken about before, a much greater volcanic activity in the past because the Earth was splitting apart. Pangaea was splitting apart into the continents that we now have today. And as that was happening, you had tremendous tsunamis being formed that then had these huge waves that were going across these plates that were drifting apart, and thus forming the multiple layers. And then as more and more of these waves came crashing, you would have more and more layers. And then, as the Earth then, like in, the great Rocky Mountains here in this continent, as the continent then pushed itself up from both ends to create the mountains, these layers, which were, clay and dirt and mud, then began to fold back on themselves. And if you go to Colorado, you see multiple examples of this. And it's hard not to imagine that those folds were once clay-like. And and then obviously over time hardened, but it wasn't that long ago. I mean, the Great Flood was like 1660 years ago.
Give us some idea of how long this all took to happen then, because we read in Genesis 6 and 7 how Noah and the ark, and he's in the ark for about a year, and then he has to wait for things to dry out, and then it kind of switches narrative, and now we're talking about the Tower of Babel and how people and the spread around and languages got confused and they spread across the earth as they were commanded to do by God. But this whole changing scenario with volcanoes and climate changes and continents moving around, how long did that take? So let's say the flood starts here with 40 days and 40 nights of rain, but it doesn't end a year later. There are still changes happening for how long?
Well, it's estimated between 500 and 700 years that we had, continued volcanic activity. Of course, as the continents drifted further and further apart, then the volcanic activity would decrease. But go back and correct something. From the time of creation to the flood was about 1650 or so. 1665, I don't recall the exact number, the estimate of that. But looking at the genealogies, you can easily pinpoint when that might have occurred. And so we've had, 4,000 years or so after that, that now is the present time. And so, but it wasn't that long that all of this activity took place, and then things started to settle down. And the of course, the post flood trauma that happened to the Earth also explains the ice ages that occurred, because the more volcanic activity you have spewing up dust into the upper atmospheres, the less light you're going to have from the sun. And of course, less light means cooler temperatures, especially on the surface of the Earth, as opposed to the warmer waters, which would have started the whole thing. The waters were warmer before the flood, and so you would, the volcanic activity, along with all the conditions that would have been pretty ripe for the glacial periods and the ice ages that took place after that. But all of that, we're looking at probably 500 to 700 years before things started settling out. And by that time, Nimrod, for example, was building the Tower of Babel. And civilization was moving on, and the dispersion of peoples. There were still regions, of course, of the Earth, especially the northern regions, that were still quite cold. And so when people migrated after the dispersion of people from the Tower of Babel, some of them went north into Europe and across the Bering Strait, which was a land bridge at the time, and got into the Americas and went south to South America and those type of places. And so people migrated, relatively soon. They had to migrate. They couldn't speak the same language anymore. So the people groups got separated after the Tower of Babel.
Okay, there's another assertion in this article here. And by the way, this is an article that I found on Reasons to Believe. It's their website, reasons.org. Hugh Ross wrote the article. Don is familiar with Hugh Ross. But there's a link to this in the chat window at brokenroadradio.com if you'd like to take a look at this article. There's a section of the article where Hugh Ross says research shows that the rate at which volcanic and tectonic activity increase and decrease in Earth's history perfectly coincides with the needs of living creatures. Even the species destruction and replacement that such activity entails serves a valuable purpose in preparing Earth for human habitation and civilization. He's saying all this purported chaos is part of a plan.
Well, it was a part of, obviously, the post-flood plan. Now, nowhere in his article does he mention the Great Flood as an explanation for the geology that, we started the discussion with. But post-flood, after God created the Earth and he placed man on Earth, or created man on the sixth day, at the end of the sixth day, basically, and placed him in the Garden East of Eden, in the Garden of Eden, everything was perfect. The environment was perfect for life. It was perfect for man, but because of man's sin, things started to degrade. And of course, the global flood. After the global flood, things were not necessarily perfect anymore, and so man was going to be struggling for existence. Some of these the post-flood activities helped to rebuild the Earth, if you will, into an environment which man could then inhabit. So civilizations were built off of that. You can look at the Hawaiian Islands, for example, and we say, wow, you know, the volcanic ash in the Hawaiian Islands makes it perfect for growing certain types of things. And pineapples is one of them, is probably the most popular, most well-known fruit that comes out of that volcanic soil. And you would expect that helped to build back the soil that was completely turned upside down, and completely, the topsoil was completely washed away, and now things had to be rebuilt.
Interesting. And here, Ross, I'm not familiar with his writings. I know you are. I'm surprised that that was one of my impressions reading this, is that what about the flood? What about he does not mention it, but at any rate, it's interesting to learn about the gap theory, and apparently it's pretty well passe these days. I think you've either been won over by science entirely, or been won over by people like Don Clark, who believe in a young Earth and have explained it intelligently just from what you find in Genesis, the history in Genesis, not the science, mind you, but the history that's there. Don, we appreciate what you bring to us every Tuesday. And great analysis of the gap. I guess we can crumble that up and throw it away, huh?
Well, yes. I don't know if it needs any more attention, but, if people have questions, we can answer them.
It seems like some embarrassing behavior on the part of theologians and apologists at the time, yielding to what science was telling them without critical examination of that science, which is what's happening now. And that's what we hear from Don Clark just about every Tuesday. Don, a member of the Board of Creation Moments, I want to recommend their website to you, creationmoments.com. And you'll find scientific information there, written and audio and video, that explains and supports the biblical story of creation. And so you might want to pay them a visit, creationmoments.com. Don, thanks so much. Not next week. We're going to be a couple weeks off. So as we mentioned last week, it'll be, about 3 weeks, 4 weeks before we talk to you again. So,
all righty.
Take that time off and use it productively, okay?
Okay, we'll do.
Okay.
I have plenty to do.
I thought you might. Bye-bye.
So long.